The challenges of protecting nursing home patients from COVID-19 and a sad part of Miami's racist history. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Nursing homes and assisted living facilities want protections from lawsuits. The number of seniors dying of the coronavirus within these places remains high in Florida. Congresswoman Donna Shalala joined us to discuss efforts to better protect our seniors. Also,
we call her our Harriet Tubman because she would come back and get a few, bring them to Miami.
Railroad Shop Colored Edition is a story of a little-known part of Miami's history with segregation. It's the last story put together by WLRN's Nadej Green. And speaking of leaving, Sundial is losing a member of its team. Associate producer Alejandra Martinez shared with us some of her favorite memories of working and living in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida has one of the largest elderly populations in the country. Some live in nursing homes and elder care facilities, and maybe you have a family member living in one of them. Well, the data over the past couple of months has shown just how vulnerable the elderly are to this virus and how quickly the virus can spread once it enters into one of these facilities. Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala has called on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to provide answers to the spiraling death toll at senior care facilities. Shalala is also a member of the Congressional Oversight Commission, charged with overseeing how the $2 trillion in the Federal CARE Act is dispersed across the country. And if you have questions for the Congresswoman about protecting our most vulnerable or how that federal money is being spent, give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Or you could send it on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Congresswoman Shalala, great to have you back.
Thank you very much.
You have focused a lot of attention in recent weeks to, again, this vulnerable population of seniors to this virus, and looking at elderly in senior care facilities and essential workers as well. Starting with senior care, though, thousands have died from this virus nationwide. And in Florida, we've seen the death toll climbing very quickly. What's your level of confidence, though, in the data that we're getting about elder care facilities in Florida?
I don't have a high level of confidence. The state originally didn't tell us which nursing homes. They didn't give us the data initially, so that they literally misled us about where the infections were beginning and where they're spreading. So under enormous pressure by the press in particular, they finally have done this. Look, infections in nursing homes is a long time issue. States are fundamentally responsible for protecting the elderly and the disabled in nursing homes. The federal government has a clear role, which they abandoned. Last July, they told nursing homes that they didn't have to have a full-time person working on infections. They were deregulating everything at the behest of the nursing home industry, and it's turned out to be a disaster. The third thing we did, which is more problematic, I think, and you can argue each side, is we prevented family members now from going into the nursing homes. They were our real accountability system. So it wasn't simply state standards, state inspections, the federal government role, but it was really family members. And I know this from my own family, that when we went to visit a loved one in a nursing home and we saw something that we thought was wrong, we went right up to the desk and asked to see the manager and demanded change. So that extra check we eliminated in our attempt to protect people in nursing homes from getting infections from outsiders.
And what about, when we talk about the issue of family members getting in to see their relatives, the reason was because there was that fear that, you know, you would bring the virus into these facilities.
Exactly. It was a good policy decision, but we forgot about their role in making sure that the nursing homes paid attention to things like cleanliness and protective equipment and things like that, where family members would observe things including bed sores and other kinds of things. And so you have to find a substitute for that. And the substitute for that is full-time infectious disease people in the hospitals, in the nursing homes, and real inspections and holding the nursing homes accountable. Look, we've had disasters in our nursing homes in Florida before. Everybody remembers during a hurricane when nursing homes did not have air conditioning and people died.
Hurricane Irma. Yeah.
Exactly. And seniors are particularly vulnerable, and it requires extra attention.
Reporting from the Miami Herald found that there may have been cases of coronavirus in Florida going back to January. Has there been any push on the federal level for medical examiners to conduct autopsies on the elderly dating back to that time so maybe we can get a better, more accurate count?
Not at the federal level. That would have to be a state responsibility because the coroners actually are state and county employees. I don't know how we would do legislation that would require people to go back and do autopsies at this point in time. Here's what we know. We know seniors are vulnerable. We know nursing homes have a long record of infections and of not paying attention to infectious diseases over the years. So that we know both the federal government and the state have to pay attention. They have to do inspections. They have to hold people accountable. And if necessary, they have to bring criminal action against people, or at least civil action, or close down a nursing home that's not doing its job. These are our most precious possessions, our family members. And to deny them adequate care and protections is unfathomable.
We're talking with Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala. What questions do you have for her, whether it's about nursing homes, protecting the elderly? Also, again, we're going to talk about the stimulus aid, 800-743-9576. Again, 800-743-WLRN. Before I go to the phones, Congresswoman, there's been a push by lobbying groups on behalf of nursing homes in Florida to provide an immunity from potential lawsuits. You know, families want to be able to hold these organizations accountable, but the nursing homes argue it's a pandemic. It's a lot harder than you think. Where are you on this argument?
Well, first of all, the state constitution would prevent that. I don't know. Every time we have some kind of a serious health crisis, out of the woodwork comes people asking for indemnity. These institutions have to do their job. If they provide evidence they did their job, they're not going to have a problem with lawsuits. But it's not clear that they've done their jobs, and certainly hiding information by the state isn't helping anything. But indemnification is very difficult in Florida because of the Constitution. Torts belong to the state government, not to the federal government. And this is not the time to start indemnifying people.
What do you want to see happen when it comes to testing and treatment in nursing homes right now? Again, because the numbers that we see, the percentage of deaths of COVID-19 in Florida, very high in these facilities.
Well, right now, if you're homebound and you call the fire department, you can get tested. There's no reason why everyone in a nursing home, including the workers, should not be tested. They're on the vulnerable list. They're serving the most vulnerable, the people that are working in nursing homes, and we ought to be testing all of them.
Besides nursing homes, I did mention this earlier, you are advocating also on behalf of many of the state's most vulnerable essential workers. You've been speaking with janitors, security officers, airport employees. What are they telling you about their needs, the risks they face daily? What are their biggest concerns?
I think they're very frightened. They have to go to work. Many of these are the most low income of employees in Miami-Dade County. And they have to go to work, and they don't have proper protective equipment. But more importantly, OSHA, the federal organization that sets standards for essential workers, has not put out its standard, and we've been literally beating on them to put out the standard. But these workers are essential workers. They're now not labeled as such, but the people that clean our buildings, the contract workers that work at the airport, they couldn't be more essential. And they ought to be identified as such and given all the protections that we insist upon for essential workers in our community.
Is it on the state or is it on the federal level, though, to put pressure on companies to provide those PPEs?
Well, it's the state mandating that people that are at risk have protective equipment. We can't open this community or any other community in Florida without proper protective equipment. Right now, we're not testing people in grocery stores or in drug stores or in any of the places that are open now. And they don't all have protective equipment unless they bought it themselves. The chain stores are just starting to provide that protective equipment, but they didn't initially. And I do believe that that's up to the state to mandate that any business that opens has proper protective equipment, and any business that has to be opened has proper equipment. But we're putting a lot of people at risk, but not just people that are working. We're putting their families at risk.
I want to go to the phones. Let me go first to Chantal in Miami. Chantal, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me well?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. I have, thanks. I listen to your program every day, so it is great. I have several questions. One is, I do agree with the testing, but how long is it taking for people to get results? Are they still telling people 5 to 10 days? That is unacceptable in this country for us not to be able to help our citizen like this.
Chantel, I absolutely agree with you. Part of it is that we haven't, everybody doesn't have a testing machine that can give you a quick result. There are some, but not enough. And most people have to wait a certain number of days. It seems to me it's very difficult to open a business if when you test your workers, you can't get an immediate result.
And they are talking about, faster test results coming back, but again, we're still waiting to see that. Chantal, thank you for the call. And my apologies only because of time. Again, I'm talking with Miami-Dade Democrat Congresswoman Donna Shalala, the sole Democrat member of the coronavirus task force established with allocating the $2 trillion as part of the economic relief package. And we're going to get into that now. And again, if you have a question for the Congresswoman, give us a call, 800-743-9576. Congresswoman, how has the $2 trillion been spent specifically in Florida so far?
Well, we've certainly got quite a bit of money, but not enough. Our hospitals have gotten some of the $170 billion that allocated. About has been allocated already. So some of our children's hospital, Nicholas, got some of the money in the last tranche. We certainly have gotten that. The state has gotten some money. We have put money out for free testing. We've allocated a huge amount of money for food insecurity. That means food stamps, the SNAP program. People still recognize it as food stamps. Money for the schools to provide school lunches and money for food banks as well. And of course, allocated money for small businesses and unemployment money, though the unemployment money has come out so slowly because the state had a system that was simply a disaster, and the governor, God bless him, is trying to fix it, but they fixed it a year ago, and he knows that.
The unemployment system here in Florida, yes, the system was backlogged. It had problems already before that, and they are spending even more money to try to fix that and get more people their benefits. The other part of it, too, was the money for small businesses, $350 billion, a little more than that, for small businesses. We have heard from some small businesses in South Florida, they're unable to access those funds. Can they hope for another round of payments, perhaps? Is that an option?
Well, in the second round, in the $300 billion that we did, we did a set aside for small businesses. And we made certain that credit unions and smaller banks, because the larger banks weren't paying attention, they were paying attention to their clients, not to the smaller businesses, the small restaurants. And more people got the money that tranche. We even let PayPal and Square give out that money. So more people got that money. I think we're going to have to allocate more, but I'm really frustrated about the unemployment insurance system. 1 million people have applied, and we just have to get that money out. We've allocated a huge amount of money, and every other state is moving, and we're the last one to get money out.
And tomorrow we're going to find out unemployment numbers for the month of April. I wanted to ask you about this. There have been calls for you to step down from the task force. It was uncovered that you had failed to disclose the sale of stocks last year. As a member of Congress, you're required to do so because of your position. Why should Americans have that confidence that you and other congressional leaders are being transparent about the money allocated, considering these situations?
Actually, because I was doing the right thing, I was selling all my stocks because I didn't want any conflict of interest and putting everything into a blind trust and putting the money from the stocks in funds, in mutual funds and things like that, because I don't believe that any member of Congress, I think it's very difficult for us to own individual stocks. In the process of doing all of that at the beginning of the term, I literally take full responsibility. I forgot to report that I had sold the portfolio, and I've now reported all of that and paid a small fine for it. And it won't happen again, let me assure you. But it wasn't transparency about what I owned, because that was in my disclosure report. It was transparency that I had sold the whole kit and caboodle. I've got a couple more that I'm going to sell this month. But basically, my stock portfolio was gone by the end of the year with a couple of outliers. But everybody knew what I owned. That was disclosed.
I want to get one more call in here real quickly. Siobhan in Hollywood. Siobhan, welcome to the program.
Thank you and good afternoon. I would just like to echo Congresswoman Shalala's comments about family members, not even for big things like bed sores and abuse or neglect, but just some of the little things that staff members just can't do that families and visitors would do for a resident. And I think that we need to have some flexibility in, as we open nursing homes, assisted living facilities, to bring family members in, maybe gradually, maybe test them, maybe limit the times they can come in. But I think it's very important for residents to have another pair of eyes watching out for them. So I appreciate her comments about the importance of family and visitors.
Siobhan, and thank you.
Siobhan, thank you very much. I think you're making a really important point. It's just not another pair of eyes. It's another pair of hands. Nursing homes are notoriously understaffed, and family members provide support for their loved ones. And I don't know, once we get a treatment, it would be helpful, but I don't know whether we need to test family members before they go in. But we need to do something, because I'm very concerned. There's nothing worse than loneliness and not seeing your family members. So many of these nursing homes are making a real effort to use FaceTime and Facebook using Skype to let them see their family members and talk to them. But that's no substitute for loving family and friends. And I understand that. But boy, we just all have to pay attention to this, because these are extraordinary people that built our country, and we have a huge responsibility to them.
Congresswoman, I'm going to let you go on this. You and your colleagues in the House right now talking about another round of stimulus payments, a direct payment to American families. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think I'm so frustrated with the unemployment here that I've called for another direct payment to American families, as well as we need to give our cities in our community and our state, but really the cities, direct payments, because they're spending a lot of money. They're losing a lot of income. They'll lose a lot of income in the long run from property taxes.
Are you talking like another like $1,200 direct payment?
Yes, that. We've been talking about whether we could actually buy out the payroll in the country, but we may be too far along for that. But I'm talking about another $1,200. I just think we've got to get cash to people. And I hope people sign up for SNAP and some of the other benefits that are available. Anyone, if I could do one thing, anyone over 60 can call 311 and get meals delivered. The county's doing a terrific job on the Meals on Wheels program, and we've put a lot of money in it. And anyone over 60, they're not doing income testing, anyone over 60 that needs food can call that number and it will be delivered to them.
She is Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala. Congresswoman Shalala, thank you so much. Always appreciate the time.
Thank you.
All right, and stay safe. Well, still to come, we're going to go back in history to a story about the time Miami's elite forced out a black community to build a white-only school. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The taking of black-owned land is a common story throughout U.S. history. In Miami, one of those communities was the Railroad Shop Colored Addition. It was made up of black workers who built and serviced the railroad and trains. On today's show, we're going to air this beautiful portrait by former reporter Nadege Green that takes a look at a long-ago injustice and the courageous, resilient women who made sure no one would ever forget. Let's take a listen.
The neighborhood was created just over 100 years ago for black workers who serviced the trains passing through Miami's railroads.
Railroad Shop Colored Addition is ingrained in my memory.
That community, Railroad Shop Colored Addition, was established around 1917 in Alapata. The Florida East Coast Railroad had a repair shop in the neighborhood. Dorothy Bendross Mendingall lived in Railroad Shop.
My mom cleaned houses, and my daddy built construction. My family is a family from Alabama, which means their family members picked cotton. So to get to Miami was to get to the promised land. And to be able to live in a place that seemed to tell the story of such great promise.
Miami had only been a city for about 21 years when Railroad Shop was established as a neighborhood. And as the city grew, word spread throughout the South and the Bahamas that there was land to clear, roads and railways to build, sewers to dig. Black labor built Miami's foundation.
My dad and his brothers came to Miami, and my family was left in Alabama. And we have an aunt who's passed. We call her our Harriet Tubman, because she would come back and get a few, bring them to Miami and set them up, then come back and get a few.
The neighborhood spanned from Northwest 46th Street to 50th Street, from 12th Avenue and to 14th Avenue on the west. Bendross Mendingall was 4 years old when it happened.
I was skinny with just big, big eyes. And one of my older brothers running and knocking on doors and telling me just to wait there. My mom was at work and my daddy was at work.
It was August 1st, 1947, around 10 or 11 on a muggy and bright morning. Miami police officers on motorcycles surrounded the neighborhood. Her big brother took off to tell the neighbors what the officers told him when they knocked on the door.
To let everyone know that they had 20 to 30 minutes to remove everything out of the houses that they owned and that they would not be given any more time to get them out.
Railroad Shop had been around for 30 years at this point, when suddenly the families who lived there were being evicted with a few hours' notice. The bright morning gave way to a drizzle and then a downpour.
I just remembered the ending.
The day the police came, Geraldine Owens was also a child.
And the ending was on my birthday.
Her sixth birthday wasn't a celebration.
It was storming. And my grandfather, Malachi, he refused to move. I remember this big, fat, white police, and he had a shotgun. He had on beige pants, and he had that shotgun. And he called my grandfather, Mr. Malachi, you got to go. And I was just crying, Papa, he gonna kill you, Papa. I thought he was gonna kill him. And my sister and brother, they stayed on the porch, but I was right there with my grandfather. And he kept pushing me back, go back. And I was crying.
It took just 2 hours to put 35 railroad shop families out of their homes in the rain. Their land was being seized through eminent domain, the power for government to take private land for public purposes. This was a common tool used over and over again to take Black-owned land around the country.
They had taken, you know, things and blankets and sheets and stuff, put it on the front porch.
Appliances, furniture, clothes, everything was set out in the pouring rain. And then the police locked the families out of their homes.
They had boarded everything up.
When they were done, the officers posted no trespassing signs. That night, some families slept outside in front of their homes with all of their belongings. Others crashed with friends and family in different parts of Miami. The families who owned their homes in the railroad shop neighborhood were paid for their property, but far less than what it was worth. Some were paid less than 70% of the value. A few were able to move their homes, physically move them on flatbed trucks to Coconut Grove or Carver Ranches, now West Park in Broward County. But Railroad Shop, the community created for the families from the rural South and Bahamas who built and serviced Miami's railroads and trains, that neighborhood was demolished. Bendross Mendenhall says the families got this explanation.
We're going to need to move you out so that we can build schools.
That was true, but it wasn't the entire story. Railroad Shop Colored Edition had been an all-Black community that was otherwise surrounded by an all-white neighborhood, and those white neighbors wanted their Black neighbors gone. This was an organized effort by white neighbors who used their political connections to get rid of something that bothered them, that this Black neighborhood was too close. They worked with the school board, they spoke with the city of Miami, they lobbied them until these two government bodies agreed to listen to their constituents and take the land through eminent domain. At that time, all-white neighborhoods started to be considered less valuable if they were too close to a Black neighborhood. And finally, on August 1st, 1947, the city of Miami and the school board conceded to the demands of their white constituents to kick out these 35 Black families, to build an all-white school, and later a whites-only park. The Black families ended up in different areas like Coconut Grove, Overtown, and parts of southern Broward County, like what we now know as West Park. And the small, tight-knit railroad shop community was broken apart. Bendross Mendenhall's family moved to Liberty City.
We lost everything. We lost everything.
She's in her 70s now. She was 3 when her family was kicked out. They would tell her stories about the 2-story home she didn't get a chance to grow up in.
We all lived in one big house. So one of my nicknames was the Big House Baby.
Her parents rented out rooms in the big house to other Black families who came to Miami for work. On Sundays, the neighborhood would come alive. Families dressed in their finest church wear worshipped at either Reverend Pugh's Church or St. Stephen's Baptist Church. The buildings were a block away from each other on 48th Street. The cemetery was 2 blocks down. A regular hangout was Nat Hutchinson's Bar and Fish Market. The railroad shop area was considered the suburbs back then. Some of the homes had 5 and 6 bedrooms. One of them was where Geraldine Owens lived until her family was put out on her 6th birthday.
It was a nice house, big house. Every room had a window. And, you know, the front porch on each side, you can open up and you just always saw light in our house. We had big tin tubs, yes, and we had the outside toilets.
The kids in Railroad Shop played under the canopy of large fruit trees growing in nearly every yard.
A grapefruit tree, an orange tree, a lemon tree. We had tamarinds, bananas, mangoes. The peach mangoes were the best.
Even the fruit trees were condemned when the city of Miami and the school board took their land and tore down the homes. And then the trees were sold. The Railroad Shop Colored Edition neighborhood isn't one of the better known stories of Miami's history. But there was one person.
Georgia Jones Ayers.
Who insisted that this moment that erased the neighborhood never be forgotten.
It was Georgia Ayers who was the first to mention Railroad Shop Colored Edition in a kind of public way that I had heard.
Nathan Connolly met Ayers while doing research for his book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. He's a historian and professor at Johns Hopkins University. And he says Ayers always carried a piece of Railroad Shop history, physically carried it all the time.
Pulling out of her purse a deed that showed that her family had been living in this community, which was along the tracks that had been, you know, laid down in the 1890s.
Ayers was a dominant figure in Black Miami and activist circles. She was born in Railroad Shop, a fact she told almost everyone she met. She carried that worn and aging yellow title to her family's land with her, to commission meetings, dinners, family functions. It was always near.
The reality of a person carrying, you know, an 80 to 90 year old document on their person, in their bag, where they went, like that to me was, again, another marker that this was a deep historical moment that Georgia Ayers wanted to be sure there was no confusion about.
For a long time, she threw reunions for Railroad Shop families, decades after they were thrown out of their homes.
Inside this book, you have signatures and addresses of families that came to attend the reunion.
From 1977 to 1985, the Curry family, the Bissett family, the Davis family, the Johnson family, the Jenkins. Deborah Jones Taylor is Ayers' daughter. She grew up going to those reunions.
This is the Negro National Anthem that they did at every time they met.
Georgia Ayers gave the reunions a name. She called them Keeping in Touch, and they always included a formal program with speakers from the old neighborhood. Dorothy Bendross Mendenhall would also go to those reunions, and she says, though they were bittersweet, the fellowship was soul-filling and the food was everything.
Lots and lots of good Southern and Bahamian food. The islands. You have your peas and rice, you had your avocado, then you would have your stewed chicken, then you would have your ribs, then you would have your cornbread with your syrup.
One of the last reunions happened in 2002. It was the 55th reunion. A footnote in that program reads, little did that white racist community surrounding Railroad Shop and that racist City of Miami Commission know. By then, the all-white neighborhood that fought to keep Black people from living near them was long gone. Over time, with white flight, the area had become predominantly Black. Georgia Ayers wanted the families of Railroad Shop to be fairly compensated for the land that was taken from them by the City of Miami and the County School Board. Ayers' daughter, Deborah Jones Taylor.
She asked for the families to actually be given their children and all to be given, because a lot of the families, they struggled. They would try to get together and raise funds to help each other. But so far, as funds coming from the county or the City of Miami, no.
Her mom never did get the reparations she envisioned. But before Georgia Ayers died in 2015, she got an elementary school in Alapata renamed after Lenora Brannon Smith, the first African-American teacher of the year in Florida and a former railroad shop resident, and Dorothy Bendross Mendenhall, the four-year-old whose family was kicked out of their home in the railroad shop neighborhood on that rainy August 1st in 1947. 63 years later, she ran for a seat on the school board, the same school board that evicted her family.
The leaders of tomorrow can be found in the classrooms and on the playgrounds of today. It is our duty as a community to ensure their success today and in the future.
Bendross Mendenhall won that election and has been a school board member for 10 years now. The day she was sworn in, Air showed up with some words for the school board members.
She told them, you know, I know there's a God. Look at that little chocolate girl sitting up there that you all evicted. But Georgia Jones Ayers was known for telling what she thought. She said, now, how do you feel? Every month you got to look at her sitting up there knowing that you put her family out of their homes.
It didn't matter to Ayers that it was more than 60 years later, and this was not the same all-white school board that evicted the railroad shop families. As far as she was concerned, the school board would always be responsible, no matter who's sitting up there. Bendross Mendenhall, new to the school board, pleaded with Ayers to tone it down just a little bit. And the other board members tried to reassure Ayers that they weren't like that old school board.
Because someone said, Miss Ayers, we love her. And she would look at them and say, that's BS. You don't love anyone that looks like me. Why? Because maybe, just maybe, we wouldn't have this story that we are telling today if you really did love us. We never forget, and we don't want anyone else to forget, that we went through that.
For Ayers, it was a small piece of poetic justice to see Dorothy Bendross Mendenhall, the big house baby, in that school board seat.
Causes us to sing our favorite spiritual, My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, How I Got Over. How I made it over. Tell me how I got over. From those roots, many of us are professionals, doctors, lawyers, you name it, and of course, elected officials. We are the children of Railroad Shop Colored Edition.
Ayers was 86 when she passed away in 2015. Bendross Mendenhall wanted to honor her former neighbor and champion of the railroad shop neighborhood. Before she died, Ayers had given her some clear instructions, punctuated by expletives.
Georgia told me, point blank, I don't want a so-and-so thing from that so-and-so school board named for me.
This time, Bendross Mendenhall says it was her turn to do what she wanted.
No. She said, as long as I live. We went to the viewing, and I found a few people from Railroad Shop. I said, you know what I'm going to do, don't you? They started laughing. I said, I'm going to name that school for her. And one of her nephews said, ooh, and Aunt Georgia going to get you. I said, she's have to get me. I said, but we cannot allow certain things to go unnoticed. She deserves that school. Look where it's located.
That school, Allapattah Middle, sat on the land where Ayers was born, the land she carried the title to for decades, land that was taken by the school board in 1947. In 2015, just a few months after Ayers died, at the school board meeting that would rename Allapattah Middle for Georgia Ayers, one by one, people she had shared her story with stepped up to the mic.
The first time I ever met her, I was a lowly assistant public defender, and I made the mistake in a meeting of calling the school Allapattah. Mm-hmm. And she reminded me who had lived in that area, the horrendous thing that happened in that area that was perpetrated against citizens of this community.
We extend our full support in the renaming of Allapattah Middle School to Georgia Ayers Jones Middle School. Thank you.
Bendross Mendenhall says, renaming the school was important, but as a descendant of enslaved people in America. True justice would account for what happened long before her family fled the grueling cotton farms in Alabama to settle in Miami in Railroad Shop, Colored Edition neighborhood, only to be evicted.
I believe there is something owed. I believe something is owed to all Africans in America. I believe that because we worked free for over 400 years, we are owed a rightful and righteous compensation for all of the work.
Dorothy Bendross-Mendenhall says the work she does as a school board member will always be in honor of her family and the other families of Railroad Shop who were put out of their homes in 1947.
I am here to help those get what they didn't get. Justice is everyone having an education, everyone having a home. That's justice.
Most of the people who lived in Railroad Shop have passed away, and gone with them are many of the stories of this neighborhood, forced off of land they owned and loved, and having to rebuild suddenly with little or no help. That's a story that has been replayed in other Black communities. And in Miami-Dade, Railroad Shop Colored Edition was one of the first. I'm Nadege Green in Miami.
And that is former WLRN reporter Nadege Green. It's her piece, Railroad Shop Colored Edition. You can find more at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a Sundial producer is moving on. She's going to share her favorite memories of working on the show and life in South Florida.
That my people passed over to me. Where is IET? In a memory that I carry from when I was young. Here is my home in Miami, where they said that could be someone.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, all good things must come to an end, sadly. Sundial producer Alejandra Martinez joined the team a couple of years ago, arriving from the Lone Star State. And she took to life in South Florida like a native. I've got to give her credit. She's heading back to Texas for an amazing career opportunity in Dallas. But I did get to sit and talk with her about some of the fascinating stories and segments that she helped bring to you. And she started by explaining how she sees our show.
I think what makes Sundial so special, and definitely so special to me, is like our intentions behind the scenes and how we think about every conversation that we put on air. And with each story that we do, we really think about what sets this place apart and what makes this place what it is. Even right now with our coronavirus coverage, we hear from people who are affected by this, and then we offer them guidance or answers to just simple questions like, I can't pay rent. What are my options? What resources are available to me?
So over the course of the 2 years that you were here, I mean, you have produced hundreds of conversations. One of them was about the art installation Black Power Naps. This was so fascinating. I was a little jealous because you got to go and, you know, actually see, because you got to go see a lot of these things that you produced. But remind us about that exhibition.
Yeah, so this was like this big room and there was beds everywhere. There was water beds and like beds made out of beans, and people would get to sit, relax, and sleep. And during this installation, and you walk through it, you kept hearing like these oohs and ahs and, you know, relaxing meditation sounds. And so the artists Nabil Acosta and Fanny Sosa were basically making the argument that people of color get less sleep, and then this affects different aspects of their life, including their health.
For me, the sleep gap is really also inherited sort of generational trauma, right? It is living in our bones. It is passed down through us, right? And so Black Power Naps is really addressing that directly.
So I think one of the many reasons that resonated with me, it's because like in my family, this idea of relaxation doesn't really exist. And I think that's seen in many communities or minority communities, this idea of relaxing, and it's seen as pure laziness and has like negative connotations. So I really like that the artist and the Museum of Art and Design, which is located at the Miami-Dade College, brought that to light and then offered these communities a chance to take a couple minutes to sleep there.
And it's interesting because the way you were talking about that, you know, that's something important to you. It's not just you're fascinated by the arts, but also the issues of race and inequality are really important for you.
Yeah. And, you know, just with this exhibition, so many of these communities are either immigrant communities. There's like this idea of like, I came here to give you a better life and you're just going to kind of sit around. Let's, you know, ponte a trabajar is what my family would tell me, like, get to work, get to work. Yeah, this is definitely something that in many of the segments I did, I definitely loved producing art segments. And so many of these artists tied their installations or work back to social issues.
You know, one of the other hats that you wore, of course, is helping build that engagement with our audience. It's beyond just putting on a show and communicating with them over the air. But, you know, you think about some of the ways we've connected with them online. And I think about one of my favorite ones, which I've enjoyed working with you on, is our Sundial Book Club. It's been a lot of fun, and we've really built a really big community there.
I know. I was checking yesterday, and I was so proud to tell you and Chris, like, we've reached over 700 members, and isn't that so amazing? And we've read more than, like, 13 or 14 books. I can't even keep count. And it's one of the things I'm the proudest of, too. You know, we love reading, and we get to learn so much about how other people view this place and write about it and like the words and the descriptions that they use. But it's really cool that like we have so many members part of this online community and we get to actually reach out to them and share their comments on our airwaves.
You know, I remember starting the book club. I thought it would just be fun to talk to authors. I've always enjoyed doing that. But connecting with our audience about the books has always been probably even more a favorite part for me than I thought it would be. I'm talking with Sundial's associate producer, Alejandra Martinez. Alejandra will be leaving our show after 2 years with the program. She's headed back to Texas to work for Report for America at KERA, the Dallas NPR affiliate. Besides producing, you know, you get to do some reporting, and that's the next step in your career, which we'll find out more about. But, you know, one of the stories you did, I remember, was the Dia de los Muertos story, and you got to speak with these puppeteers in South Florida taking part in these festivities. What's the significance of Dia de los Muertos?
This is like my favorite holiday. I grew up with it. And, you know, Day of the Dead or Dia de los Muertos is a holiday where Mexican and indigenous communities of Mexico would honor their dead loved ones. You know, I really wanted to find that here and find within South Florida home. And home felt like Day of the Dead was one of those celebrations that was so tied to like my family and home. So when I found the puppeteer group and then I saw that in Fort Lauderdale, they have like a 10-year running strong Day of the Dead celebration. I was like, let me bring this story and educate people about Day of the Dead and also hear about this puppeteer community that brought it upon themselves to create this huge festival.
This has been able to bring it to my kids. I really think that if I didn't have this, then they would have like little to no exposure of what I had as I did as growing up.
So you recently partnered with The World for a reporting project called Every 30 Seconds. It's about young Latino voting populations in the U.S. And I wondered, what did you learn about young Latino voters in South Florida and how their political opinions differ from their parents?
For this project, I primarily talked to this like Generation Z, so 17 and 18 year olds that were going to vote for the first time, right? And it was really interesting to see the generational differences when it comes to politics among Latinos. What makes South Florida so different is that young Latinos here have huge ties to the countries that their parents come from. So Cuba or Venezuela and other, you know, Latin American governments where they have a very strong history with like communism, and that history resonates so much with the Latinos and young Latino voters here. So seeing how their parents' history and their cultural history still resonates with them today and seeing how that influences their political decisions when it comes like to this presidential election was just like very eye-opening. And then I was just so inspired by like this young generation who's like so informed and so politically active.
You know, as we mentioned, you're heading off to Dallas. You're going to be working for the Report for America and the NPR member station KERA. Tell us about this new job.
Report for America, basically the core mission of this program is to place young journalists in like these local newsrooms to report on like undercover issues and communities. So I'm going to be in Dallas reporting on how COVID-19 or the coronavirus is impacting minority communities.
So Allie, I mean, I could think about a whole bunch of really awesome memories that we've had working together. Lots of cool stuff that we've had the chance to do. And I'm just wondering for you, is there a behind the scenes kind of story that you want to share of your adventures here?
I mean, there's so many. Like one that I really liked was after a trip to Key West, Chris, who is like the other producer of the show, is like this huge hot sauce person. And he wanted to try the spiciest hot sauce. And basically, it was like after this long trip, and we had just had an incredible show at Key West, and we had to at least do one fun thing.
I remember that trip to Key West. I remember that trip to the hot sauce place. I remember Chris's face turning many shades of pale. And he did it, though. He handled the hottest hot sauce they could give him. Congratulations. Anyway, again, want to thank our associate producer, Alejandro Martinez. The voices you heard from the piece were artist Neville Da Costa and Day of the Dead celebrator Susanna Cacique Coleman. Allie, we're going to miss you. We really are. But congratulations on this move, getting back to Texas. And, you know, good luck in your future endeavors and everything you do. You help make this show fantastic, and we're going to miss you. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, May 7th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington. Alejandro Martinez is our associate producer, at least for another day, as well as our social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Jason Zapka is our program director, and Peter J. Meritz pushes all the buttons. Next week on the program, we're going to be talking with Palm Beach County Superintendent Donald Fennoy. We're going to take your questions. If you have questions for him, you could also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Start sending them now. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. Stay safe, as always. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.